Our series for this church year, as you know, has taken the overall title Foreigners, and we're looking at what it means to be a foreigner in your own culture because you are a believer. And the call to be a foreigner is not easy. Jesus never said it would be. In John chapter 16, he says these well-known words, "I have told you these things," he says, "so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble. But take heart, I have overcome the world." Jesus never said it would be easy. And in this series, we're looking at being naked in the midst of this trouble, this difficulty that we face in being believers. In other words, to be seen for what we truly are becoming in Jesus Christ. We want the world to see us as we are being reshaped and reformed by the power of His Spirit and His Word in our lives. Now, this is hard enough in the public square, which is what we were thinking about last week. It's hard enough before authority figures in society and in work. But how much harder is it not before those who know us intimately? Relationships between men and women our center stage right now. Marriage is under attack, we are told. I kind of don't get the panic in some people's minds about what is commonly called gay marriage. You would nearly get the impression from what's going on in society at the moment that the single biggest threat to the institution of marriage is all the argument and so on about whether or not those who are homosexual should be allowed to marry. It isn't those who are homosexual who are destroying the institution of marriage. It's those who are heterosexual who are destroying the institution of marriage in our generation. But there is this tension at the moment about it. The Church of England cannot make up its mind about female leadership. Will they? Won't they? Well, yes, they will. And then, no, they didn't. And we still live in a world where women don't get paid the same amount of money for doing the same work that a man does. So what would it look like to live as a foreigner with my spouse? What do proper relationships between men and women, especially within the institution of marriage, look like within the kingdom of God? What would it look like to be naked before the family? Well, Peter addresses this issue next. Last week we looked at how he talks about life in the public square, in politics, and in work. But next he comes to the issue of men and women in marriage. Now, Peter was a married man himself. Not only so, but we find out in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 that Peter's wife accompanied him on his missionary journeys throughout the Roman Empire. And so you might expect Peter, being a married man, to have fairly conservative views on what marriage should look like, especially if they were to his own benefit, as most men's views generally are. You don't agree? Okay, fine. And so you might expect that he would be fairly conservatively minded about this. The reality, however, is that in the section of his letter that we're going to look at tonight, these seven short verses, Peter takes a highly radical approach to defining marriage relationships. In one sense, what we're going to look at in a moment or two, there's nothing new here. All he does is he takes the vital missional principle that we discovered last Sunday and he applies it now to marriage and family. Because we know that because to both husbands and wives in this section, in those verses I read just a moment or two ago, he starts off in verse 1 by talking to the wives and he says to them, in the same way. And then later in verse 7, he starts by talking to the husbands saying, in the same way. In the same way as what? In the same way as he had previously addressed believers about their relationship to authority figures in politics and also in work. He takes the same missional principle. We are a missionary people. That means that we must live in such a way that we can testify to our masters, whether they are political or occupational. And that's what we were talking about last week. The reality, however, is that though we must live in such a way that we can testify to our masters, many of these people we don't even like. don't like a lot of the politicians. We don't like a lot of the people we have to work for. We don't even like these people, yet we accept that Peter says that we have to live missionally towards them. How much more then will we want to live missionally in marriage and in home life when we are now talking about people we actually love? But how are we going to do that? Well, in these verses, Peter talks first of all to wives and then to husbands. So let's have a look at what he says. Let's take a journey through his text. And let's look first of all at the naked wife. There are six verses on wives and only one on husbands. Now, I know what you're going to say, especially if you're female, right? Okay, I might have known, okay, so it's a man writing it, he'd have far more to say about what women need to do than what men need to do. Okay, there actually is a reason for this. We discovered last week that one of the groups that Peter spent a bit of time talking to were slaves. Why did he address them? Because more slaves were likely to be Christians than their masters were. We know from the history of the early church that lots of those who came to faith in Christ were slaves. They were of the poor, not of the wealthy or influential. So it's not surprising that Peter had nearly more to say to them than he had to say to masters, because more of his audience would be slaves. And it is also true that wives, whom Peter now addresses, were much more likely to be Christians than their husbands. And in the early church, that was one of the ways by which the early church grew. It was through the influence of slaves upon their masters and wives upon their husbands. So in these days, the church grew in large measure through their witness. And Peter realized this. Do you know what that, do you understand what that means? It means that in terms of winning the Roman world to Christ, these women were potentially more significant than all the evangelists, elders, and apostles of the church, most of whom were men. These were really significant people if you look at the world missionally, as Peter does. So what does the naked wife look like? The naked wife is someone, Peter says three things about her. First of all, the naked wife is someone who aspires to submission. This is where Peter begins. Wives, submit yourselves to your own husbands. Now, don't switch. If you're female, don't switch off at this point, okay? Just stick with me for a minute or two. Peter says this in an interesting way. In the Greek language, which Peter's letter is written in, there are a number of ways to indicate whether what you are saying is a command or a statement. Command is called an imperative, and it uses a certain tense and of the verb and a certain structure of sentence. This sentence is not an imperative. It is not a command. The form of the verb used, for those of you who want to be technical and who remember enough about your Latin from school days, the form of the verb is participial, which means this is an aspirational statement. Peter is saying this is something to aspire to, not something you can necessarily always fulfill, nor something that is necessarily always sensible to fulfill. Men don't know everything about everything. They may think they do, but they don't. This is an aspirational statement. Furthermore, the only context dealt with here is that of the home. See what Peter says? Submit yourselves to your own husbands. Women are not to be generally submissive to men. They are not to accept a set of circumstances in which they are taught to believe that women are somehow inferior to men. That's not what Peter's saying. This has got to do with wives and husbands, but no other male-female relationships. Last Saturday, I listened in the church hall to Judith Gillespie, who's a very high-ranking officer in the PSNI, and she told the story of how she applied initially to join the police. She and her then-boyfriend, subsequently husband, put in their applications on the same day for the police. Within a few weeks, they both got letters back. His letter welcomed him into the, thanked him for his application and told him that he'd been successful and gave him a date to show up, when to start. Her letter said to her, thank you very much for your application, but we have no vacancies for women at the moment. As she was better qualified than her boyfriend, she was a bit miffed. So she applied again, and she got the same letter. It took quite a while before a situation which she was not required as a Christian, which she is. She was not required as a Christian to accept. She kept pushing the door because there was something unfair about this. The Bible does not say that women are inferior to men, that they should always accept a submissive position to men. So she kept knocking at the door till she got in. Now you know what has happened in her career. In fact, the women Peter addresses here had some remarkable freedoms. Remember, we're talking about the people in Asia Minor here in modern-day Turkey, not the people who lived in Palestine. So the women that Peter is addressing here had much more freedom than their sisters who lived in Palestine. For example, women in this part of the empire could run a business. In another part of the empire not far away from here, we meet Lydia in Philippi when Paul goes there. And she is a businesswoman. She has a business in cloth. And this was possible in this part of the empire. Furthermore, they had some measure of economic independence. They had money and they could decide how to spend it. We'll come to that in a moment or two. And these wives, because they are Christians, had probably left the religion of their husbands and perhaps their families, which was something rare in the world of Peter's day. So these women to whom he writes were not submissive women who accepted what men said and that was that. They could have been businesswomen, they had a degree of economic independence, and they had already asserted their own independence in following Jesus Christ as Savior. But Peter says that for missional reasons, they should offer submission to their husbands, some of whom were not Christians. They could not be required to do this. And Peter was not making a command. He was calling them to aspire to a different way of life. Husbands could not require this of their wives. As we'll see later when he comes to deal with husbands. Husbands have no right to require this of their lives, of their wives. Peter invites the wife to offer it. It was a freedom that she had. And he sees this offering of submission to their husbands as a powerful gospel sermon. So that, Peter says, if they do this, if any of them, that is their husbands, do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of their wives. St. Francis of Assisi famously said, "Preach the gospel always, and if necessary, use words." The danger was that these husbands may have been a little bit tired of words. Women are great talkers. That's okay. It's a wonderful thing and it helps family life when at least somebody's talking, not always buried in the newspaper or watching the TV. So it's wonderful if someone talks. That's great. But sometimes if all this man's wife had to talk about was Jesus Christ and what Jesus had done for her and how much of a difference he could make in his life, there might come a point where he got a little bit cheesed off with that. And so Peter says, look, there is a different way to be missional. Because the problem is if you keep on talking, what will happen? Your husbands will either switch off altogether, developing that wonderful selective deafness that I think all fathers and husbands should have, or they will become angry with frustration because they can't take any more of it. But, says Peter, they will not be able to be like that when they see the purity and reverence of your lives. What we have to understand here is that Peter is not interested in establishing some domestic culture or in propping up an already existing one. Peter is interested in calling men and women. At the moment, he's talking to the women. He is interested in calling them to live missionally. You see, Peter talks about these women's lives being marked by purity and reverence. A person who bows before the Lord in genuine reverence acquires a life that is shaped by that. I used to notice, I grew up in the city of Derry, and loads of women in the city of Derry worked in the shirt factories. So they spent long hours hooched over sewing machines. And you could pick them out in the street. My mother-in-law was one of them. You could pick them out because their back was arched because they spent so many hours in this particular position that it came to impact not just where life, their life when they were at work, but through adopting that posture at work, it began to shape their lives outside of work. And when we are those who bow in reverence before the Lord, our lives get shaped by that. Wasn't Jesus' life shaped by that? Wasn't the reverence and devotion that he had for the Father expressed as he bowed himself in prayer in the long hours of the nighttime? Didn't that bowing shape the life of Christ? For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus' life was shaped by his reverence for the Father. This is missional life. And it's what Peter is asking of wives. He's saying, allow that position that you have learned to adopt before the Lord, allow that to shape your life, especially in the way in which you relate to your husband, and your life will become a missional life. You will win your husband. He was calling women to aspire to submission. But also, the naked wife breaks the stereotype. She breaks the stereotype. This letter shows that little has changed in 2,000 years. Pick up any women's magazine. Not that I do, you understand, but pick up any women's magazine and you will find features on hair, jewelry, and clothes. Just as if you pick up a man's magazine, you'll find articles on gadgets and cars and sport, okay? It's a stereotype, right, of what women are interested in and what men are interested in. And Peter calls Christian women to break the stereotype. Your beauty should not come from outward adornments such as elaborate hairstyles and the wearing of gold jewelry or fine clothes, okay? Now, obviously not all women in the churches of Asia Minor were slaves. As we said a moment or two ago, some women had a degree of economic independence, enough economic independence to be able to spend money on their hair or on jewelry or on clothes. Some obviously lived in wealth. So what is it that Peter wants here? He wants Christian wives to be frumpy, right? They're not allowed to have a nice hairstyle or nice clothes or wear jewelry. No, that's not what he's saying. There is here no condemnation of these things in themselves, but rather an appeal to women not to allow themselves to be defined in this way, to break the stereotype which says that the only thing that matters about a woman is her outward appearance. The persistent social pressure, especially if these people were wealthy, to be little more than a trophy wife. Break the stereotype, he says. Break the stereotype. Don't be someone who is defined almost exclusively by your outward appearance. For one thing, as he points out, this can't last. Even if there are some people like Jane Fonda who manage to look like that at 75 and depress us all. It won't last forever. But Peter says one form of beauty does last forever. Rather, he says it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. What was Peter saying? Peter was saying you can't photograph real human beauty because real human beauty is on the inside. And this beauty that Peter speaks of here is not a rehash of Aristotle's view of women. It was Aristotle's view of women that basically governed the thinking about the inferiority of women in the world of Jesus' day. And it was Aristotle's theory about women that became the inherited theory of the Christian church, not the teaching of the scriptures. And Peter is not backing up Aristotle's view. How do I know that? Because the chief example of that beauty was not a woman, but a man. It was the one who called people to himself so that they could find out what rest meant. It was the one of whom the prophet Zechariah said, "See, your king comes to you, gentle, riding on a donkey." Christ-likeness was not just the preserve of Peter, who walked with Jesus those years of his earthly life, who saw him and heard him and lived in awe of him. Christlikeness was not just the preserve of Peter, who did all these things, but also of his wife, who displayed the beauty of Christ in a gentle and quiet spirit. How mold-breaking was this? Peter calls wives to break the stereotype, and the naked wife, lastly, is not scared. Of course, this approach to marriage came with no guarantees then as now. The reality was that the law of the Roman state was such that Roman husbands could use prostitutes, they could require female children to be abandoned, they could divorce their wives. Marriage in the Roman Empire was a disaster zone, just like it is today. Those who were critical of Christians, remember we talked about them last time, that there were a lot of people in society who were critical and spreading rumors about the Christian faith, which were untrue. Some of those who were critical of Christians almost certainly included men who were married to them. And it might be tempting to think that Peter's motivation in this call for the wives to be submissive is for the safety of the wives. You know, if you keep your head down, you'll be all right. Maybe he'll not divorce you. Maybe he'll not walk away and leave you if you keep your head down. But this was not Peter's reason. Peter was, as we've already said, encouraging these women into a missional practice. And for an example, he quotes that of Sarah, Abraham's wife in the Old Testament, who called her husband master in a rather whimsical passage. You can read it later for yourselves in Genesis chapter 18 when three strangers come to the tent and Abraham makes them a meal, and then one of the strangers tells Abraham that even though he and his wife are quite old now, that at this time 1 year later he's going to come back and Sarah's going to have a child. And Sarah laughed, you know, behind the tent. And when she talked to herself about this in Genesis 18, if you look it up later, you'll see she called Abraham her master, her Lord. But the point that Peter is making here is that even though she laughed herself and thought, this is the most ridiculous thing I ever heard in all my life, that I have a child at my age. Come on. She still made the meal for the strangers when they came. And because she did conceive and have a child a short time after the visit of those strangers to their home, she obviously involved herself. She made herself subject to her husband's crazy vision. She was not scared. Nor is the naked Christian wife scared to stand up for who she really is. Even in the context of a difficult marriage, she is not scared to stand up for who she really is, because it is the Lord in whom she trusts and not her husband. And it is in faith in that Lord that she stands firmly unafraid. So tonight, wives, you get to choose. The chances are, your husband has never seen you naked like this. As someone who aspires to submission and when you have been doing this already and are almost at the end of your tether because you've sought to be loyal to what the scripture says, but it appears to have made no difference. He's still as unreasonable as he always was. There still seems no sign of a crack in the armor of his total opposition to all that you believe and all that you are. When you get even to that point, don't give up. Just remind the Father, because it was his idea that to be the naked wife in this way was the missional way to change the world. The naked wife, and then the naked husband. To Christian husbands, Peter has less to say. But what he says is truly powerful and radical. As we've noted, the wives, like wives, husbands are called to live as slaves do, because the passage starts in the same way. So husbands are not to focus on forcing their wives to behave as Peter calls them to. So all the stuff we've just been talking about the wife is not something that a husband can require of his wife. He's not in charge. Difference, of course, is that a lot of these Christian women Peter's talking to, their husbands were not Christians. Most of these Christian men, their husbands, their wives were Christians. In one sense, it was easier for them. Peter calls the husbands to be considerate as you live with your wives. You might think, well, that's a bit of a cop-out, really, isn't it? I mean, he tells the wives to submit. He tells the husbands to be considerate. What on earth does considerate mean? You know, that's a pretty wishy-washy kind of term, you know? That means making you breakfast occasionally or something like that. Maybe not even that. Just means bringing the milk in from the door. Actually, the term be considerate means literally according to knowledge. Peter's saying there's work in this, okay? It's a bit like anything that's new to you that you don't understand and know very well. I got a new car a year ago. I'm not comparing the car to my wife, you understand. That's not what I mean, but just live with me for a minute. I got a new car a year ago, and it's a diesel car, okay? And I haven't had a diesel car for a while. And diesel cars used to be totally different from petrol cars. You get in a diesel car, you can start it in any gear, okay? Now they've made diesel cars, it's just exactly the same as petrol cars. There's absolutely no power of any kind below about 2,000 RPM. If you get in the wrong gear at a roundabout, you could be seriously fried. So what you have to do is you have to, over a period of time, to realize the properties of the engine in the car that you're driving and make sure you are in the right gear so you don't end up in trouble. You need to act according to knowledge. You need to come to know and understand how the vehicle works. You need to know and come to understand how your wife works. What makes her tick? What explains what she says, what she does, who she is? To act according to knowledge. That's what to be considerate means. And it is applied, therefore, to every aspect of my wife's life. I need to understand it all. This is something I have to work at. And here Peter becomes radically countercultural again because he goes on to say, and treat them with respect as the weaker partner. Now, this is quite interesting because in the world in which we live, we do not respect something or someone who is weaker than us. We only respect people who are strong or stronger than us. I listened to Fighting Talk on Saturday mornings on Radio 5 Live. It's really good fun. And it kind of makes the journey down to the butchers and back a little bit more interesting. So I was listening to it yesterday, and one of the questions they had on the, I don't know if you've heard the show, but three or four folks on the show kind of have spar about sport and stuff like that. And very stereotypical, but anyway, because they're mostly men. So yesterday, one of the things they were talking about was when the crowd got it really wrong. You know, if somebody gets really injured on a football pitch, what happens? Everybody boos them, you know. And one of the guys on the show was an ex-professional footballer, and he told a story a number of years ago when he was on playing in a game, and one of the team members went down in the penalty area, and he was rolling around in pain and so on, and this guy was standing over him, shouting at him, "Get up, you big girl's blouse." Well, he probably wasn't saying it quite like that, but on the radio show, that's what he said. "Get up, you big girl's blouse. Stop rolling around there." It transpired. This guy had seriously injured ligaments. He could barely walk, and he was about 6 weeks out of the game. But because he thought he was play-acting, you know, somebody thinking that they're weak, "Oh, get up." That's our attitude to weaker things and weaker people. And yet Peter says, respect them because they are weaker. The word for respect here is the same one Peter used in chapter 2, verse 17, when he talked about our attitude to the emperor. We should have the same attitude to the emperor as we have to our wives. But for them, it is because they are the weaker partner. What's he referring to? Probably the fact that bodily women are factually not as strong as men. And usually a man can overpower a woman physically in any given set of circumstances because generally speaking, they are stronger. They are made stronger. Their muscle frame and all the rest of it enables them often to dominate. But Peter says, because that is so, they need to be respected more, not because they need sympathy or pity. If you think your wife needs sympathy or pity, just try. But for missional reasons again. 1 Corinthians 1, God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. My wife is weaker than me bodily, and so in her I am to see something of the glory of God at work, because God chooses the weaker things to shame the stronger things. If I want to see the glory of God, I am more likely to see it in her than in me. So I honor her because of that. Furthermore, in respect of our faith, we stand side by side as heirs with you, these women, your wives, as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life. I have nothing in Christ as a man that my wife does not share with me. Which means, Peter says, if I fail to honor her as I should, I will neuter my prayers. God will not listen to me. God will not listen to me if I fail on this point, because my wife is a joint heir with me of the things of God. Could it be that the shameful attitude to women embraced by the church over the centuries explains why the prayers of the male leadership have often gone unanswered? Men who live as they do just because they can are greeted by the silence of eternity. I have often mentioned C.S. Lewis's book, That Hideous Strength, and I know you're fed up with me talking about it, and I know you never read it, but I want to read you. It's essentially That Hideous Strength. It's a fairy tale for adults, really. It's how C.S. Lewis describes them. They're kind of sci-fi novels, and the last one is set in a university town in England. It's largely a love story, actually, but it doesn't read like that when you pick it up. And at the end of it, the two main characters in the story, a husband and a wife, come back together after a very difficult set of circumstances in the book. You need to read the book. And when they come back together again, by the time they come back together, the man has realized who he really is, and he is ashamed. And this is what he says. He is about to meet his wife again after a period of time when they have not been together because he has been involved in some stuff which is really bad. She has ended up being his redemption in many ways. So they're about to meet up again after having been apart for a while. And he's waiting for her to come. And this is what he says. But then he says certain moments of unforgettable failure in their short married life rose in his imagination. He had thought often enough of what he called Jane's moods. This time at last he thought of his own clumsy importunity. And the thought would not go away. Inch by inch, all the lour and clown and clodhopper in him was revealed to his own reluctant inspection. The coarse male boar with horny hands and hobnailed shoes and beefsteak jaw, not rushing in, for that can be carried off, but blundering, sauntering, stumping in where great lovers, knights and poets would have feared to tread. An image of Jane's skin so smooth, so white, or so he now imagined it, that a child's kiss might make a mark on it, floated before him. How had he dared? Her driven snow, her music, her sacrosanctity, the very style of all her movements, how had he dared? And dared too with no sense of daring, nonchalantly, in careless stupidity. The very thoughts that crossed her face from moment to moment, all of them beyond his reach. Made, had he but had the wit to see it, a hedge about her, which such as he should never have the temerity to pass. Yes, yes, of course, it was she who had allowed him to pass it, perhaps in luckless, misunderstanding pity. And he had taken blackguardly advantage of that noble error in her judgment, had behaved as if he were native to that fenced garden and even its natural possessor. The naked husband. Read the story, because it doesn't end like that. So you get to choose if you're a man. You get to choose. to choose to live missionally with your wife. As the weaker vessel, she is more suited than you to bear the glory of God. Didn't you notice that? And what answers might there be to your prayers if you embraced her in that way? Has your wife ever seen you naked like that? We all get to choose tonight. The band's going to come. We all get to choose, husbands and wives. We get to choose to live the way the world tells us to live. Or we get to choose to live missionally, naked before people who know us intimately. We get to choose. What will we choose?